My name is Diana. I am a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, who has overcome poverty, anger, shame, sadness, fear, guilt, perfectionism, and more recently, stigma. I continue to struggle at times with depression, isolation, and some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the plans I have for Diana, declares the Lord, plans to prosper her, not to harm Diana, plans to give her a hope and a future." I am the oldest of three children. My earliest childhood memories are unremarkable. My mother was lovely and sweet, and my daddy made me feel safe and loved. But this soon changed in ways so subtle and awful that I am still not able to pinpoint exactly when my mother stopped being the person I ran to for reassurance. This is an all too common scenario for children trapped in an environment shaped by mental illness. Both of my parents developed a serious mental illness while I was young, causing me to feel confused and unsure why the behaviors of my parents were different. Many times I often looked for ways to change things back by modifying my own behavior, putting additional stress on myself. Additionally, religion was a part of my home, often playing a significant role in the symptoms that were displayed by my mother, whose major illness was schizophrenia. As a young child, I waffled between God is love and I am bad. I knew scripture memory verses by heart from Sunday school, and I believed that God was out there, somewhere, but I must not be doing something right, because my life experiences were very negative, and no one ever said, I love you. Often I felt so alone and isolated. Mommy, Mommy, where are you? Running through the house, I panicked. I didn't know how to rebuild the dwindling fire in the coal stove. After checking all the rooms downstairs, I quickly climbed the steep steps to the upper part of the house. I ran looking in every room, stopping to peer out through the fog of the steam windows. Exhausting all options inside, I finally resorted to exploring outside, still cold and wet in the pre-dawn. Mommy, Mommy, where are you, Mommy? I called into the silence. Seeing the big wooden door to the old coal shed ajar, I approached it. Peering inside, I saw Mommy, lying face down in the coal with her nightgown on. Reaching in, I put my hand on her shoulder, slightly shaking her. Mommy, what are you doing? She raised her head and turned slightly toward me. Her unwashed hair encircled her coal-smeared but still beautiful face. Slowly, she opened her eyes in a stupor. Leave me alone. I'm praying. This is my prayer closet. Go back in the house. Placing my hands on my hunched shoulders, tightly hugging my thin nightshirt to my shivering body, I put my worried face close to hers. It's getting cold in the house, and I can't fix the stove, I implored. I'll be in when I'm finished, she scolded. Go on back in. The grass, wet with the morning dew and frost, slapped my bare ankles as I ran back to the house, up the stairs, and to my bed, huddling under my cold covers, trembling on the outside from the chill, and on the inside because something wasn't right. As a child of the mentally ill, I believed that my life was normal until I attended school and observed that I was different. I learned at a very early age to hide the chaos I was experiencing at home and to show a different face in public. But behind the public facade, I was a young, confused child who longed for a stable home environment and a sense of being loved. I sought positive reinforcement from my teachers, and I took an interest in school and succeeded academically. I sought validation from my peers, but this proved more elusive. Yet any academic or social success that I earned was frequently overshadowed by the stigma of the differences in my family, as opposed to a normal home. My adolescent years began promisingly, and for a brief period it seemed our family's fortunes were on the rise and life might improve. We even moved into a new house. But this peaceful interlude was brief. Soon we were again plummeted back into a violent and unhealthy place as my mother's condition worsened and my father was diagnosed with a terminal illness. The increasing severity of my mother's illness left me largely responsible for the house and my younger siblings, while she vacillated between staying in bed and emerging to periodically frighten us with her erratic behavior, or argue viciously with my father, who became increasingly violent as his health worsened, requiring even more medical attention. With both parents experiencing and exhibiting these intense symptoms, we as bewildered children were left to fend for ourselves. And many times I had to step into an authoritative role in order to survive. Mostly at night I would escape with my record player listening to my favorite Southern Black gospel group, Teddy Huffman and the Gems. I found that I would more efficiently cope with the external if I put my mind on Jesus. One song, All the Praises, gave me hope. The lyrics are, "All the praises will be given to my Jesus. He's the one who helped me when I was down all the way. He's the one who made me what I am today." Since I didn't believe that I was anything on that day, I hoped that someday I would be pleasing to Jesus. So with hot tears wetting my pillow, I would pray, "Jesus, please make me something." My hope was in the future, of things getting better, but things only got worse. I was a senior in high school and alone with Dad in his hospital room. Cables were hooked up everywhere, machines were running, but all I could hear was my father's labored breathing. He was so frail and weak. I walked softly over to the bed, taking his almost lifeless hand in mine. I bent my head toward his and put my lips close to his ear. "Daddy, I'm here. I'm here with you." His eyes showed recognition as they barely opened. Suddenly, the subtle hum of the machines became a raucous din. I ran to the door and flung it open. "I need help. My dad's not breathing," I shrieked into the hallway. The doctor came running, and then putting his hands on my shoulders, he looked intently in my eyes and softly said, "Your dad is gone." I thought, "Gone? Gone? Gone where?" Then I fell lifeless into the doctor's arms. Although I had expected him to die, it all seemed so sudden, and I was unaware that gone was forever. I had asked God numerous times to heal my dad, and now God's answer was a final no. It was at this point the tender edges of my heart began to harden. The symptoms of mental illness may be mimicked by other brain disorders, such as the brain tumor my father suffered. I began to seek help for my family during this tumultuous period, but not knowing where to turn or how to present my situation, I was rebuffed by those in positions to help me. Confused and isolated after the death of my father, I looked outside my family unit for stability. Through the years, professionals in the system often failed me by either not believing me or not knowing how to resolve the issues. Family members were frequently reluctant to intervene as well. They feared outcomes such as institutionalization, or perhaps they grew up in a home also tainted by mental illness, which may be hereditary. I took on a job with grown-up responsibilities, and finally finding love, I threw myself into my relationship with my boyfriend, eventually marrying a few months before high school graduation. All the while, I continued to search for help for my siblings and my mom. Only after a horrific episode of abuse against my sister did I finally manage to find someone empathetic to intervene and get my mother medically evaluated. I pressed the button on the elevator, taking me to the psychiatric floor. I inquired at the nurse's station to see my mother. This was a part of the hospital I had never seen before. The armed guards stood alert, protecting the unwelcomingly sterile ward which was populated by patients in white robes. It looked like a place where no one would ever get better. I froze as a frightened anguish gripped me. The social worker's words pounded in my head, "Your mother has been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia." I didn't want to be associated with whatever that diagnosis involved, but this environment confirmed my worst fear. My mother was insane. The fallout from my mother's declaration of mental incompetence was almost as devastating as her illness. She was stigmatized as a crazy person and subjected to a series of deplorable living situations. My siblings were separated and sent to foster care, and I reached the lowest point in my young adult life when our family home, the one tangible thing that was most like everyone else's, along with most of our belongings, were sold at public auction to pay the medical bills so that my ill mother might finally receive treatment. Having struggled for 14 years to find help, I found myself devastated by the form it took. I was angry and bitter at God. He had taken my father, taken my mother, taken my home, and now he had taken my brother and sister, split them apart, and separated them at long distances geographically from me. At the age of 20, I was powerless and subject to great suffering to circumstances whose causes were not entirely understood. I had not dealt with the death of my terminally ill father and the emotional scars I had of having to select his casket and write his obituary at the age of 17. During these unique situations, I was faced with the ups and the downs of swinging emotions, which put me at risk for all types of physical dangers during my tumultuous adolescent years. But even more so, the development of my own mental health was threatened. As my mother struggled with treatment and medications, my siblings and I began to find our own way, finally freed from the burden of caring for a woman with a serious mental illness. I took control of my career, pursuing higher education even as I worked full-time and bought my first house. During this period, I endured the deaths of more than one grandparent, but this experience, so common in young adulthood, affected me deeply as I had already lost so much, and I was especially grieved over the loss of my grandmother. My grandmother was a true model of the love of Jesus. When I think of my grandmother, I'm reminded of the lyrics of the song, "Thank You." Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am a life that was changed. One by one they came, far as the eye could see, each life somehow touched by your generosity. Little things that you had done, sacrifices made, unnoticed on the earth, in heaven, now proclaimed. As Jesus took your hand and you stood before the Lord, he said, "My child, look around you, for great is your reward." These losses spurred me to a greater understanding of my situation as I desired to be like Grandma and to make her proud of me. I began to make peace with my extended family members as part of my personal healing process. And from my reaching out, more of my family's history was revealed to me, including some instances of a history of probable mental illness. During this time, I also became more involved in my mother's treatment, researching her illness and taking an active role in her welfare, eventually successfully petitioning to be named her guardian. She eventually moved into her own apartment and, with the assistance of care workers, began to have a life complete with social activities and hobbies, although treatment and medication continued to be a struggle. I also experienced the great personal triumph of receiving my bachelor's degree at the age of 31. With these milestone achievements came exciting new job prospects, and I decided to move away from the town I had always called home in search of my own fulfillment, and with the hope my mother would be spurred to greater independence. Of course, I continued to monitor her treatment and progress and made sure she was well looked after even after my relocation. My professional life was thriving and the things that around me seemed to be going better. However, the bitterness still resided buried in my heart, and I used the excuse that because I was in a new town, I didn't need to find a church just yet. The ongoing church weeks became years, and eventually I believed that life was just as good without actively having a relationship with God as it had been when I attended church and served Him. Just as I had learned to ignore circumstances in my childhood, I chose to ignore that my marriage was disintegrating behind the scenes. But it was harder to ignore a health condition with a non-malignant tumor. I was forced to confront the issue of motherhood and treatment for myself. I sought counseling and spiritual support during this time as I confronted the many emotions I had locked away during the years. I was struggling with internal anger from the aftermath of my parents' illness and how their situation was now affecting my decision to not become a mother. It had taken 24 years for my mother to be correctly diagnosed and treated, and thus able to once again live independently. That was 24 years of my life as well. Now that I was no longer the primary caretaker, I was forced to face the emotions I had successfully stifled during my childhood and the ramifications of this oppression. Realizing that I must surrender all to God, all the hurt, all the mishaps, and all the disappointments over to the plan that God had for me, I paid a visit to my spiritual father, who was a pastor. During one of his services, he called me forward for prayer and had a prophecy over me. He proclaimed with increasing authority, "I see you dancing and running and laughing in fields. The chains of abandonment and rejection are broken off of you, and all that you set your hand to shall be done with excellence." Pausing briefly, he then declared with increasing momentum and authority, "Many will say, 'Look at what the Lord hath done. Look at what the Lord hath done. Look at what the Lord hath done.'" I began to tremble, and as his hand moved off of my head and as he backed away, I went limp at the power of the words and collapsed. As I lay on the floor, I could hear my spiritual father saying, "Glory, glory, glory. God is doing a work." At that point, God began the healing process, even though I didn't see the results right away. Over the next years, it was evident that through my pain and suffering, I had built resiliency, developed a faith in God. And even though at times I didn't see it, I did have a support system of many godly people in my life, which helped make it possible for me to soar above the years of neglect and abuse and take positive steps, such as entering counseling, nurturing friendships, and pursuing higher education. Eventually, little by little, putting the guilt and the shame behind me as I looked forward. In the middle of my life, I began to make peace with what had happened and take control of what was to come. Always a caretaker, I strove to keep my family close, hosting my siblings and their families and making my home a center for gatherings and holidays. I continued to excel in my career, setting and achieving one goal after another, but I was again faced with personal setbacks and loss. My marriage, which had been troubled for some time, ended in divorce after 28 years, and a substantial loss of assets, and my home echoing my horrific childhood experience. I grappled with that verse found in Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for Diana, declares the Lord, plans to prosper her, not to harm her, plans to give Diana a hope and a future." I decided at that point that everything I was personally and professionally, and everything that I had in the physical was God's. I must turn it all over to Him and completely surrender all of the internal, the hurt, the bitterness, and all the external, the material possessions and the accolades. The sudden death of my spiritual father, a man I had long taken comfort and strength from, forced me to again endure the grieving process. But this time I was able to face loss without feeling broken, and I began to truly embrace my past and my emotions, returning to thank the people who had made such a difference in my life. I rejuvenated my religious life, returning to and becoming more involved in church, and turning my life over to God. I began the Celebrate Recovery program, where I found both a great source of strength and healing as I connected with others who had experienced awful pains and life situations, learning to be overcomers. Going through the group sessions and working through the workbooks prompted me to look at painful areas of hurt, which I had buried under the layers of outward success. The lesson on sanity especially ministered to me. Earnestly believe that God exists, that I matter to Him, and that He has the power to help me recover. Sanity has been defined as wholeness of mind, making decisions based on truth. Matthew 6:34 says, "So don't be anxious about tomorrow. God will take care of your tomorrow too. Live one day at a time." In the summer of 2013, I was a participant in the Celebrate Recovery program at the Winchester Church of God. That summer, I attended the Celebrate Recovery East Coast Summit. While there, I went to a session on how to write my testimony. I came home and I wrote for 3 months. As I wrote, I was amazed at the healing I received as I relived the mess and the hurts of my past. My testimony ended up being a book. The book is an unflinching look at my personal journey, what I have learned, endured, and overcome, and what effect mental illness had on a child trapped in a home with two parents suffering from two different and horrific diseases which affected their mental capacities. Standing in the Winchester Church of God in August 2013, God gave me the title for the book. He said specifically, "You are a child of royalty." I said, "How can I be a child of royalty? I am the complete opposite." God's reply was, "You were born into the right family. You have a royal bloodline, and I am preparing you for greatness." I was and still am overwhelmed at the word of the Lord to me and the doors that He is opening for me to speak and proclaim my testimony of His glory in my life. I was one of the invisible children, robbed of my childhood, forced to deal with way too much at a young age. I was judged and marginalized when what I truly needed was hope, inspiration, encouragement, and knowledge about how to free myself from the guilt of my parents' issues and stay resilient in the face of such overwhelming adversity. Although I continue to experience sadness, it has taken me more than half my lifetime to get to a point of peace, purpose, and satisfaction, to understand that I had done all that I could do, and now I'm at last free to live my own life. But most importantly, I'm learning my value and who I am in Christ. Although recent statistics from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill state that 1 in 4 Americans will experience mental illness each year, it continues to be the elephant in the room. We all know about it. Most of us know someone affected by it, and yet we just don't talk about it. While my autobiography doesn't exactly have a happy ending, it does offer hope, show a way forward for those who seem to have few options, but most importantly, to show the hand of God on my life. I want others to know that I made it, and they can too. I want to share my path and my pain and my joy for the glory of God. I believe there is a price to pay for the anointing. And if God can use my story for His glory, then I humbly submit my scarred and painful past for His message and purpose and hopes that many may be inspired and healed. I am a child of the mentally ill. I am a child of royalty.